Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 75. My name is Karen, and I'm joined by Kristen.
Hi, everyone.
Only you got to see my jazz hands when I said 75, but I feel like people felt it.
Right?
Yeah.
Could just feel the energy.
Yeah.
Speaking of, if I am a little down on the energy today, I blame the 3.5 hours I just spent in a car driving all over the state of Michigan running errands with my boyfriend. Oh my god. It's just that, like, his dad lives up there, so it was like, we gotta go do that, and then we needed to, he's a realtor, so we had to go put a sign in a yard, and it was like, burr, 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 burr. So, now I'm home.
Yeah.
Well, home.
Why, aw.
I'm in Toledo, which is home. I'm not at home.
Yeah. Your home, my home is your home. I really tried to mess that up like 3 times.
It's all good. I like it.
Yeah, I'm a little down on energy too because I've been working all weekend. I worked like all day yesterday, which was Saturday, and worked a little this morning, and then went out to lunch. That was nice. And then went to Costco on a Sunday afternoon, which was not fun.
I also went to a Brazilian steakhouse today, which is another reason why my energy is low. Yes.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. And I'm going to give a brief description for those who do not know what I mean by a Brazilian steakhouse. No, it is not just like a steakhouse. In a Brazilian steakhouse, you show up, you sit down, they have a cold bar, so like a salad bar, so you go up, and we were there for brunch, so they had like fruit and bacon, and it was really good. So like, we went up, you get some of that stuff off the bar, you come back, you eat it. Then you flip a little thing over at your table, and they start bringing meat to your table.
Yeah.
Literally, just these guys with giant cuts of meat on big skewers.
It's a little intimidating.
And they come up to your table, they cut a piece off, you take it with your little tongs, put it on your plate, and then you eat the meat. So it's like, there was like top sirloin and New York strip, and then they had chicken cover, chicken wrapped in bacon, and steak wrapped, they had this garlic steak that was so good. They had spicy Brazilian sausage, they had lamb, that, you know, whatever. So I tried some stuff. I had the Brazilian sausage that was really good. That garlic steak was amazing.
Yeah.
It was the last bite I ate. I was like, I'm not eating anything after this. But like the bacon wrapped chicken was really good, and I had a couple of different beef steak sides, top sirloin, regular sirloin, New York strip. Every time they came by, it was a new side of beef. I was like, what are we doing? But I do not need to go back for another 6 months at least. I will need time to recover.
It fills you up fast, all that meat. Like,
it's so crazy. Yeah. And it's the first time I've ever been there. I know you've been to one.
Yeah, I just recently went to one for the first time.
And it's just a very overwhelming experience.
It is.
Because you're sitting there and there's these people just coming up to your table. And a lot of them are very attractive men. Who would like come up to the table and like offer to carve. I swear this one guy looked like David Diggs. I'm not even kidding.
Really?
He had like dreads, but he looked like David Diggs. And he was like, you know, they like carve a piece of meat off and give it to you. And it's like, it's just a lot. And I kept telling Alex, like, I feel like I need to clear my plate every time they visit. Like, I need to be faster. And he's like, you're fine. And I'm like, I know, but I feel pressured. And he's like, you're not pressured.
It is,
no one cares.
Yeah, it is overwhelming because it's also like every time they come up to you, it's like, I have to make a decision right now if I want this. And when I say no, I'm like, am I going to regret that? Like,
Like, the garlic steak guy came by once and I said no. No, because I had like 4 different chunks of steak on my plate, and I was like, no, I don't need another. And Alex goes, you're gonna regret that. And then he ate his. He likes his steaks very, very like medium rare.
Yeah.
I am less choosy. The one he had was like closer to well done. The last bite we had was perfect. He goes, okay, I feel bad because I told you were going to regret it, but you got the better one. He's like, you had the better bite. But yeah, it was a really good experience and lots of fun and so much food. So
I would like to go back again because, I mean, I probably will at some point, but I feel like the first time you're just like wide-eyed and like, it's very overwhelming, like you said. And now I'm like, now that I kind of understand how it works, I'll probably feel a little more relaxed. And
yeah.
Also, you need to, like, be able to spend some time there so that you can, like, just sit and... Because it's very expensive.
Yeah.
But if you can sit and leisurely eat, then it'll be worth it.
Our reservation was for when they opened at 11, and we didn't leave until, like, 1:30.
Cool.
Have fun.
I went to a Japanese steakhouse and had hibachi, which was mediocre, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. But
the mediocre hibachi is...
Yeah. I mean, it's still worth it.
I get hibachi from a Japanese place, but it's, like, a to-go Japanese, and I love it. Like, that one. Like, I've had it other places and been like, it's fine. Yeah. But, like, I know I like theirs.
Anyway. If you want to tell us what you ate for lunch today, you can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com.
I promise, we are still a Percy Jackson podcast, even though we just regaled you with 5 minutes of what was for lunch.
Yeah, but that's okay. I would like to think that people like to hear about our lives outside of Percy Jackson, but maybe they don't. I don't know.
I like to think so, too.
Yeah. All right, jumping into news and updates. I'm sure many of you have heard this already, and for those that haven't, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but Lance Reddick passed away on March 17th at the age of 60 from natural causes. Lance has already played his role in Percy Jackson and the Olympians. He already filmed his scenes as Zeus. And so, yeah, it was very shocking. You texted me. I had no idea. You texted me. And I just was like, what? And then just the whole timeline started filling with tributes and pictures and just shock. And
I was shocked. Like, all of a sudden I saw a headline and I was like, wait, no. Like, I was hoping it was a hoax or something dumb that had been going on. But no, I was really, really upset to hear. Because, especially because he's got so much going on right now. Like, he just put out another movie and then John Wick came out. It's coming out soon. And with Percy upcoming, like, he's got all these... Mm-hmm. things going on, and it just is such a shame to lose him so
not far. Only was he super iconic, but he was still working, still getting huge roles and doing a lot of stuff, and it seems like it was, you know, pretty surprising. Like, we don't know what the actual cause was, but it seemed like, you know, it was taking people by surprise. He wasn't at the John Wick, like, screening, the red carpet, I think it was. Okay. He was still at home, but he had just posted something 2 days before on his Twitter, and it was just, like, one of those things you were like, wait, what? Like, I can't comprehend this.
Yeah.
Rick did write a blog post on March 18th titled "An Appreciation for the King of Olympus," and I really liked what he said, so I really want to read it for you guys if you hadn't heard it already. He writes, "We are devastated to hear of the untimely passing of Lance Reddick, our Zeus in season one of Percy Jackson and the Olympians. I've been in shock since yesterday, trying to understand how such a vibrant, kind, and talented man could be so quickly taken from the world. I met Lance on set just a few months ago, and he could not have been more wonderful and welcoming. His gravitas and regal bearing made him perfect for the King of the Gods, but from what I could tell, in person he was nothing like the blustery and distant sky god. He had a marvelous and quirky sense of humor. He was thoughtful, caring, and piercingly perceptive. He was a multifaceted artist who elevated every part he played, from Cedric Daniels on The Wire to Charon in John Wick to Zeus in our own show. A musician by training, he seemed to bring that sensibility to the screen, quickly reading the tempo, the melody, and the structure of every piece, finding his place in the ensemble, and then creating unforgettable, unexpected interpretations that turned the compositions into masterpieces. As a fan, I will miss him terribly. As the creator of Percy Jackson, I will never see Zeus in the same way again, and I feel so fortunate that our paths crossed, if only briefly. It will be difficult working on those scenes in which Lance appears, not just because we mourn him, but because they will remind us of how much brilliance we have lost. At least it's comforting to know that we'll be able to share that performance with Lance's millions of fans, and we will get to see his artistry in action one more time. As for me, I have trouble believing such a force of nature could ever really be gone. I will choose to think that maybe Mount Olympus simply had need of their king. Godspeed, Mr. Reddick, and thank you."
Man.
Tearing up right now.
I know. It's a little hard to, like, read. And Rick has obviously such a way with words. Mm-hmm. And I really loved the way that he described the musicality of Lance's performance as Zeus. And I think that it's just going to end up being really emotional when we do finally see him on screen.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that he was a part of the Percy Jackson family and obviously will continue to be in memory a part of the family. But it's still, like, I'm still shocked. Like, yeah. I still keep seeing pictures on our timeline and everything. And I'm like, how is this real? Like, we haven't even seen him as Zeus yet. And we've already lost him. And for people who have been longtime fans of his, I'm sure it's very, very difficult. His wife posted, I believe, a little message from his account, and she did say that donations could be made to momcares.org in Baltimore, which was his hometown. And Becky tweeted this out as well, and she said that momcares.org supplies much-needed support postpartum to at-risk families in the Baltimore area. And she also said, as someone who had a number of serious postpartum complications, I'm making a donation today, which I thought was really, really sweet. So if you do want to give, that is a very good place to do it, and is obviously seems like a very good organization to contribute to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's tough, and I'm sure that we'll be continuing to talk a lot about Lance, especially when the show comes out. I also wanted to talk about two of the articles that Reed Riordan put out this past week. The first one is the top goddesses you should be worshiping this Women's History Month. And I will say, Kristen, do not read this article because there are Kane Chronicles spoilers in there.
Fabulous.
Yes. So
this is why we let Karen do the news.
Yes.
Because Kristen has read less of things, and so she does not look.
Yeah, but it was a pretty cool article with a very good, I would say, like, diverse group of female deities, so that was pretty interesting. And they also wrote about what do your favorite gods and demigods have planned for spring break? There's a good mix of people in there as well. I saw some things, you know, we've talked about Reed Riordan before, not always having a finger on the pulse of the fandom. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some things about this article that other fans haven't loved. So, you know, kind of take that with you as you go to read it. But
yeah, I saw some of that too.
Yeah. And I also wanted to mention that, of course, the Sun and the Star tour will be going on in early May. I saw from Becky that Boston is selling out pretty quickly. I don't think New York City is open yet, so keep an eye on that. They will definitely let you know as soon as possible when that is available.
By the way, we're recording this on Sunday, and we're releasing it Monday, so check again when you hear this. Check again.
Yeah, keep checking every day. But I also wanted to mention, because I had kind of forgotten about this, and then I saw Becky tweet some stuff about it. I was like, oh yeah, that's a really good idea. If you can't make it to a tour stop, be sure to check your local bookstores to see if there's like a midnight release party, because this is a Percy Jackson book, you know, and Nico D'Angelo is obviously a fan favorite character, so I'm sure that for the bookstores who know the significance of this book, they might want to try to plan something for that.
I was gonna say, also maybe check your libraries too, because I know they've done special release parties for, you know, really big stories and really big books, and this is, I mean, these days, this is almost as big as it gets, you know.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much.
We haven't had quite the huge tentpole book series recently, but this is definitely as, you know, as big as it gets for, I mean, it's Nico.
Yeah. So even if you can't make it to a tour stop, see if, you know, somewhere local has something that you could do. And maybe you'll meet some new friends, and maybe you can tell them about Prophecy Radio.
These two really cool girls that you listen to. Just kidding. We're not cool at all.
But that's okay. I feel like that's the reason why people like us sometimes.
Agreed.
Because we are super nerdy. And speaking of super nerdy, I decided
to do some research today. So our main discussion today, if you remember, is basically about Greek and Egyptian religion, mythology, culture, society, the way that they influenced each other over the years. And I put on my little nerdy hat, my little scholarly cap, and decided to do some research. And by research, I mean I created an account for JSTOR, which I haven't used since college.
Nice.
So that I could read some actual academic articles to bring you guys some information. And just so you know, you can make a free account on JSTOR and read 100 articles a month.
Nice.
So that was actually very exciting, which tells you what kind of fun I have in my spare time.
Right. This is how Karen spends her Sundays.
But, I mean, that being said, I actually did have a lot of fun looking this up. And, you know, I have a degree in art history, so I've always been super interested in this. If I had carried on with my degree in art history, I would have studied the classics. So, like, Greek and Roman specifically was my main interest, obviously. But Egyptian always really interested me as well. And I kind of, this brought back some memories of things that I've studied in the past, and also kind of triggered some memories about the Cain Chronicles. And I was like, oh yeah, that's totally a thing. So
nice.
I think between last week and this week, as we keep reading, this is going to be like invaluable information.
Well, I can't help, but as I was reading today's chapter, which again, we'll get to at the end, it's the last thing we talk about, there's definitely some references mm-hmm. to how Greek and Egyptian culture kind yes. of overlap via the Rosetta Stone, which, again, yeah. we'll talk about what it means in the book. But, like, the connection was not lost on me. I was like, wow, we're about to do this episode where we're going to talk about how they connect. And the chapter literally has them connecting on a piece of stone that we've all heard of.
Yeah.
And so I just thought it was really funny that, like, we decided to do this episode. And mm-hmm. then, boom, the chapter just kind of perfectly was like, phew.
Yeah. I actually talk about that in this, nice. Like, this discussion as well. And even some stuff from last week is relevant to this week's chapter. I'm going to see if you picked up on it or not.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But I want to start off this with a history lesson before we get into mythology. Again, like last week, this is a very generic overview. This is, like, super basic. I pulled from a lot of different sources. I will be linking to the sources in the show notes because I didn't want to, like, leave you guys hanging, and I also felt better just, like, citing where I pulled these things from in case I'm wrong about something.
Karen went full academia yes. on you today, so if you want to see the articles she read, she'll have them for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. That'll be nice, though.
Yeah, just in case you want to do further reading and stuff like that, because I really wanted to, like, dive deep into some of this stuff, and I was like, keep it simple, Karen, because we only have so much time to talk about, you know, this before we get into the chapter. But I want to start pretty much at the very beginning, which is that
Very good place to start.
Yes, it Sorry. Is a very good place.
I'm going to stop now.
No, that's fine. It is a very good place to start. You got me. Egyptian society is about a millennium older than Greek society. So the Egyptians and their culture were around a lot longer than the Greeks. And the two were in contact in the second millennium BC. And by 600 BC, Greeks were frequent visitors to Egypt. So there was a lot of, you know, crossing between the two of them.
It's not that far apart, like, geographically.
No, no.
So it makes some sense yeah. that they could travel between the two.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And Greek intellectuals actually had a great respect for ancient Egypt, and they believed that it did have a large influence on Greek culture and religion. So even back then, a lot of the philosophers and historians saw Egypt as this, you know, realm of wealth and culture and everything, and they really loved it in a lot of ways. Greeks also regarded Egyptian religion as kind of exotic and sometimes bizarre, yet full of ancient wisdom. So it was like, oh, this new shiny foreign thing, but we can maybe learn something from them, which is, like, actually really cool because a lot of cultures and stuff
are kind of xenophobic and they see other cultures and they're like, let's conquer them and change them to our religion and our culture versus the Greeks. And we see this with the Romans too, kind of incorporating a lot of that culture. Now, the Minoans were the first form of proto-Greek civilization. So what we kind of understand as like ancient Greek civilization, the Minoans were like the first instance of that. And this is roughly when the Egyptians first made contact with the Greeks. And like I was saying, you know, talked about language and everything like that, Egyptian hieroglyphics influenced and were integrated into the Minoan society, eventually being adopted by the mainland Greeks. And this became the first form of writing used by any Greek civilization.
You know, I'm kind of just thinking about, like, what the Greek alphabet looks like. Mm-hmm. And while it's not hieroglyphics, it is a very, like, line-structured kind of alphabet. Like,
right.
You know, I can't even think of a specific Greek letter that's, like,
Delta.
Delta. Yeah, thank you. Or, like, Alpha, Omega, Delta. Like, there is some curvature, but it's almost, like, picturesque. It's, you know, it feels more kind of like a step between
I can almost
Egyptian
see that.
Hieroglyphics and our modern alphabet that we use. I'm talking about English, so I guess it's the Roman alphabet, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, like, I really think that's actually kind of fascinating to think that as Egyptians and Greeks, like, started to meet in this very first, you know, the Minoans, like, in that first form of it, that they may have had some real interaction. It may have, you know, affected the Greek alphabet, which goes on to be useful and is still very useful for math. There's a lot of math that they use. I know. They use tons of Greek letters and Greek specific symbols to mean certain numbers or, you know, pi. Isn't that a Greek letter too, I think?
Yes.
I think pi is Greek. Anyway, but I'm just saying, like, it's, yeah, that makes a lot of sense and is kind of cool if you think about, like, what some of those letters look like and kind of figure, like, that had to have come from some sort of Egyptian hieroglyph, like, they morphed it a little and made it their own, and that's really cool.
Yeah, which we will talk about when we get into the chapter.
Okay.
Because it's very specifically referenced to this period.
Mm.
And this period took place during the Late Bronze Age, which was somewhere around 1500 BC. So this was, you know, quite a while ago. Now, at the end of the Greek Dark Ages, around the 7th century BC, the Greeks established a colony in Egypt called the city of Naucratis. And this was very, very important. This is, like, really, in terms of Greeks and Egyptians influencing each other, this is, like, the center of that. It was mostly a trading post, and its establishment meant that Egyptian and Greek culture could flow between the two civilizations, influencing art, religion, society, and much more. And one of the specific examples I found was in terms of Egyptian art influencing the Greeks is the form of the statues called Kouros, K-O-U-R-O-S, which were a depiction of ideal youth. And this kind of blended Egyptian and Greek art styles into kind of this medium one in between the two.
Again, if you think about Greek pottery and you think about all the visuals that are put on the outside of it and how those tell stories, it's not that far from Egyptian hieroglyphics. Like, I don't know if my brain ever put together just how close those really do look to each other. But, you know, just thinking about it now, I'm like, yeah, that really does make some sense. Like, that's how they told stories, was putting the visual story on the outside of a pot or on the outside of a vase or whatever. So, like, yeah, that's really cool.
Like, yeah. And I think, you know, it's so interesting to me because Greek culture, Greek mythology, all of that is very influential today. We've talked about that before in terms of even the United States and how we've incorporated a lot of those art styles and stuff into our society and everything. And yet Egypt is so much older, and obviously the two developed separately in a lot of ways. And there are things that were very much Greek in origin, but once you come to later periods of times where they blend a little bit more, it's interesting to me that, I mean, I guess I kind of know why, because Greeks were a little bit later, they lasted a little bit longer, and with the Roman Empire and everything, there's a reason why that stuck around a little bit more than the Egyptians, but going through and reading some of this stuff, I was like, oh, I didn't realize that the Egyptians were so much older, despite having studied our history. It's been a while, guys. But I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And like I was saying, the Greeks continued to advance in their society, while the Egyptians began to decline, and they were subject to foreign invaders time and time again. One of those times was during the Hellenistic period, which should give you a clue as to the fact that it was the Greeks that took them over. This was from the 4th to the 1st centuries BC, and it was following the conquests of Alexander the Great when Egypt was taken over by a Greco-Macedonian dynasty based in the new city of Alexandria. Now, Greek pharaohs communicated in Greek, and the country became bilingual and bicultural. They respected the Egyptian gods, very much how we've seen the Romans would assimilate the religion and culture of the areas that they conquered. This was obviously super smart, because that's the best way not to have the people you just took over revolt against you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're like, oh, my life's not really going to change that much. We just have, like, a new guy sitting in the seat on top of the pyramid. That's not how pharaohs work, but you know what I mean.
And we may end up with using some Greek money instead of ours. Okay, yeah. Maybe, you know, I can get, you know, it's minor things, right, that rather than trying to overhaul an entire population's belief, right, system.
Yeah, and I mean, religion obviously is very important to people, yeah, and especially when you're praying every day to certain gods and stuff, like, to wipe that clean would be such a mistake.
Well, and as well as cultural practices, like, a lot of them stem from things that make, you know, like, logical common sense. Like, you know, in Egypt, it's a warmer climate, it's sandier in some places. Like, there are cultural practices that become sacred outside of religion, mm-hmm, that you don't just forget because somebody, right, shows up and says, hey, we've conquered you, you're now our people. Like, you want to continue to do that. So it is really smart by the Greeks to not just, like, walk in and start killing people and making people fall in line via fear. Right. But instead, they say, like, yes, we are, you know, now in charge of this land, but, you know, you can continue to go about your lives. We're not here to rule with an iron fist.
Right. And I think it kind of goes back, too, to how the Greeks saw ancient Egypt, that it was a place full of wisdom and practices that they respected, even if they did find it different from their own.
It pretty much comes down to respect.
Yes, exactly.
Looking at you, Columbus. Anyway, we're just going to keep walking right past that.
Yeah. We did conquer you, but, you know, we respect you.
And the respect means that we're not just going to stomp all over everything you think, right, is important in your life.
Yeah.
Which, again, common sense. Anyway.
And because of this, too, Egyptian religion continued to spread throughout the Mediterranean as a result. Because if you think about it, the Greeks and the Egyptians were so much closer than they ever had been, because the Greeks had literally taken over ancient Egypt. And so that spread of information was really just going everywhere throughout the Mediterranean. And especially the worshipping of the goddess Isis, who was assimilated into Greek worship and eventually into the Roman religion as the cult of Isis. And religion during this time was increasingly syncretic, which was a neat little word that I learned, meaning that it basically combined Egyptian and Roman beliefs and practices into one. And when you're talking about something being syncretic, it's sort of like, we see this a lot in other places where you basically just combine it into, like, kind of when we were talking about Amun-Ra, like, you combine them together and now they are one new form. So it doesn't really, like, erase other parts of it. It just puts them together, blends them. You know, synchronizing is kind of like,
yeah,
the same root word.
That's, you know, kind of where I was thinking it, yeah, kind of came from. Like, that makes some sense.
Right, yeah. Yeah. But I found that to be really interesting, too, just the way that, especially Isis, who kind of goes from Egyptian to, like, kind of Greek into becoming even a bigger deal in Roman society as well, which I don't get into, but at some point we'll probably end up talking about down the line.
Yeah, if it seemed important.
Right,
maybe,
exactly.
Maybe a little.
I wanted to talk about religious and mythical crossover, too, because this is sort of what we were aiming at. I needed to kind of give some of that background. But I was really particularly interested in how Greek and Egyptian society influenced each other's religion and how maybe the gods spread their influence throughout these different kingdoms. Now, like I said before, the Greeks loved ancient Egypt. Many Greek philosophers traveled to and studied in Egypt because they did see it as a place of this immense wisdom. For example, a Greek mathematician named Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S. I should have looked up how to pronounce this, but I did not. He studied the pyramids of Egypt and used them to create some of the first theories and formulas about angles. So there's just a lot to learn in ancient Egypt. The Greeks kind of took that back to Greece, and they built upon the foundation that the Egyptians already had laid down for them. Now, Herodotus, which I feel like a lot of people have heard, he's a fairly famous historian. He's considered the father of history. He believed that Egyptian gods were Greek gods in a different form and often drew connections between them. And this is specifically called Interpretatio Graeca, which is basically equating foreign divinities with their own.
Mm-hmm. Which would make sense.
Yes. And if you think about it, really makes it easier to accept, like, for the Greeks to accept Egyptian society.
It's basically what we do on a weekly basis, where you take something that you're reading that's brand new, like this book about a demigod and his possible Egyptian lineage that we're going to get into when that chapter finally tells me all this important information that I don't have yet. I know we're getting there. But, like, I don't know anything about the Cain Chronicles or all that much about Egyptian mythology, so my brain is constantly trying to equate it with Percy Jackson and with the Greek gods and trying to find those through lines, because until I know more and more and more about Egyptian mythology, until I am meeting these characters in the story, I don't know enough about them to make leaps and jumps. So it makes total sense that that's how he, you know, makes those connections. Like, he sees that they have a pantheon of so many gods, and he says, we have that too.
You're right.
So they must be, there must be some sort of connection. May not be a one-to-one, like, you know, 5 cents is 5 cents.
Yeah.
But, like, it may be a, oh, well, this guy, they have this god who is basically the lord of the underworld. Well, that's very comparable to Hades, so we can kind of connect them.
Mm-hmm.
That makes, again, it just, that seems very logical.
Yeah.
And makes total sense.
And I would just imagine it would just, you know, stop you from breaking your brain, basically.
Being
like, what do you mean there's a whole nother civilization with a whole other pantheon of gods? Like, it would be like, you would question everything you've ever learned in your entire life versus just accepting that, okay, so our gods may have started in Egypt and the Egyptians needed them to be a little bit different than we needed them to be. There's reasons why this god is associated with this. Like you were talking about with the different societies and what's important to them, like what's important to Egyptians versus the Greeks is going to be different. So therefore their gods need to represent different facets of society.
They've got different climates, they're dealing with different situational things, and, you know, feeding your population becomes different, so you have a god who is specifically the god of grain, because growing grain is impossible in a place like Egypt, versus in Greece, where it's a lot more hospitable for crops and the climate is different. You're not going to necessarily have a god of, you're going to have a god of the harvest, because that time of year is going to be plentiful and all that. Mm-hmm. So it makes, it makes a lot of sense.
Or even the fact that olives were so abundant in Greece, it would obviously make sense that they would have a god who kind of represented that. And when they're importing and stuff like that, you know, giving that to the Egyptians and everything, it just makes sense that that would be that god's purpose in ancient Greece and not necessarily the same in ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
So Herodotus did equate some of the gods And the big ones were Zeus and Amun-Ra, which to me makes a lot of sense because Amun-Ra is like pretty much the most powerful deity, really the most widely worshipped, kind of a sky god, sun god yeah. sort of thing. You can see the connection there. Apollo and Horus were equated, and Apollo being a sun god and Horus being a sky god as well, like, those kind of make sense.
They also both struck me as being, like, younger.
Yes.
Like when you think of Zeus, you think of, like, the old man Zeus. And right. Amun-Ra kind of gives you that big, like, I am powerful kind of thing. Whereas when you think of Horus and Apollo, they kind of feel like the younger brother. They're not, necessarily, but they feel like the younger brother of, you know, of that.
Yeah. Horus was Amun-Ra's son, and Apollo is Zeus's son.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So that works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes, obviously. So, yeah, that works very well. And some of the other ones, we did touch on some of these. Demeter and Isis, Artemis and Bast, Dionysus and Osiris, Hephaestus and Ptah. And there are seemingly no equivalents to some of the other gods, like Athena, Ares, etc. So this doesn't work all the time. And like we were saying, a lot of the attributes to each individual god in their separate societies don't necessarily match up one-to-one.
Yeah.
But it's like the vibe they give is like similar. So the Zeus god and the Amun-Ra vibe, you can kind of combine them into.
So they be vibing.
They be vibing. That's going to be the episode title.
I knew it. As soon as I thought it in my head, I said, she's going to like this.
Yes.
Right? They be vibing.
Yeah. Now, what is super, super interesting, and this is one of the things that jogged loose some memories for Kane Chronicles.
Okay.
When Ptolemy the First, also known as Ptolemy the First Soter, which is like when he became the Egyptian pharaoh, like that's sort of what he named himself, he made himself king of Egypt, and he created a new god. I believe it's actually pronounced Serapis, S-E-R-A-P-I-S, to basically garner support from Greeks and Egyptians. He was the patron god of Ptolemaic Egypt, combining the gods Apis, the bull god, and Osiris with Zeus, Hades, Asclepios, who was in charge of medicine, Dionysus, and Helios. So there is this, like, precedent for this Serapis. You know, it's not like he was like, oh, this god is brand new, just met him for the first time, you have to pray to him now. It's like this is born out of something that Greeks and Egyptians would already know, and it was like a new version of some of these other gods where he was like, yes, look at, you know, things have transformed, they've changed, here's a new god that kind of represents this new era. This is very important to something that happens in the Kane Chronicles a bit later.
Okay.
And I did not know that when I read that thing.
Okay.
So
light bulbs are going to go off for me.
Yes.
That you did not have the valuable insight to know.
Right.
When you read it.
Yes.
So I appreciate.
But this is very, very, very interesting, and I just love the way that Rick ends up using it. So I'm just saying right now, remember this moment, Kristen. Lock it in your memory.
Lock
it in. You might
not
get to it for a good long while, but I'm gonna
turning keys.
Yeah.
I'm locked away.
Make you
hopefully it
remember.
Will reemerge when I read the thing.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Serapis had powers over fertility, the sun, funerary rites, and medicine. You can see how this would be, like, really important to society, somebody that you would definitely want to, like, pray to. Like, keep me healthy, make sure I get to where I need to go after I die, make sure I have kids, and make sure the crops grow.
Right. I mean, those are the big four.
What else do you need in life other than that? Probably some other things, but
maybe
but that's a good start.
Exactly.
And this was basically characteristic of the dynasty's use of Egyptian religion to legitimize their rule and strengthen their control. So it was definitely very, very purposeful that he did this, but hey, it worked really well. And that's part of the reason why the Greeks could rule over the Egyptians and there not be too many issues with that.
Yeah. They're not conquering, they're ruling. It's
right.
A little different. Like,
yeah.
they've technically conquer them, but it's not like the things we think of when you think of someone conquering someone and they're slaughtering millions and whatever.
I'm sure a lot of people died, and there was probably a lot of people who did not enjoy this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's quite as bloody as other conquerors. Right.
And I think the fact that they assimilated them into their society, and they themselves assimilated into Egyptian society, is like a huge step in the right direction if you're going to conquer people. Yeah. I mean, don't conquer people in general.
Yeah.
But if you have to, assimilate.
Not assassinate.
There you go. That needs to be on a t-shirt.
Assimilate, not assassinate.
Wow.
We're going with that, dude. Yeah. All right.
I like it.
Let's keep it moving.
Okay. So the Greek story of creation sounds a lot like the Egyptian goddess Maat, M-A apostrophe A-T. Sometimes there's not an apostrophe in there, so I think it might just be Maat. And both share themes of stability, order, and the antagonizing of chaos. So in ancient Greek, we've gone over this before, in the beginning, there was chaos with a capital C. And from light, Gaia, Mother Earth, and Uranus, Sky. Sorry, I almost called him Daddy Sky because not another Teen Wolf podcast. We keep referring to people in Wolfpack as like Daddy Wolf and Daddy Ram and all this other stuff. So like, that's where my head went. I apologize.
It's hilarious.
So they came into being along with some other primordial gods. Gaia and Uranus had 12 children, the Titans, plus many other monsters. And it led to the Olympians. We kind of know the rest of that story. Now, in the Egyptian creation myth, the world arose out of the lifeless waters of chaos, so very similar, called Nu, N-U. The first thing to emerge was a pyramid-shaped mound called the Benben. I really like that.
I do too.
I like that it was pyramid-shaped too, because obviously very important to the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. The sun then arose from the mound, a.k.a. Ra. Ra is the sun. Who replaced chaos with his daughter, Maat, the goddess of harmony, justice, and truth. She represents cosmic order. So you can see some of the equivalencies there. You can see where the Greeks may have derived their own creation story from some of the elements of Egyptian society.
Yeah.
There are two other stories slash people that I want to talk about when we're talking about the Greeks being influenced by the Egyptians, because these were two of the stories that really jumped out to me in terms of like, wow, this is really obvious, the like through line between these two societies. The one is the wandering of Io, and we talked about her before. Basically, Zeus fell in love with her. She was Hera's priestess. Hera got very mad, as she does, and turned her into a heifer, a female cow. Io was then watched by Argus and then attacked by a gadfly. I really remember the gadfly part. Yeah. And basically, the gadfly made it so that she just kept walking. And she kept walking all the way to Egypt, where she then gave birth to Zeus's son, Epaphus. Now, cows were revered in Egypt. And last week, we talked about the cow goddess Hathor. And Hathor Isis, another one of those like combination fuses like Amun-Ra, in some versions, Io is turned into a cow maiden, not a heifer, much like we see Hathor with the cow ears and stuff. Io had like horns and she was like a cow lady.
Okay.
So you can already kind of see where there's some similarities here.
Not a cowgirl, but a cow maiden. A cow lady. Yeah.
I should have said cowgirl. That would have been really funny. Then I would have pictured her with, like, cowboy boots and a hat.
And then the little horns.
Some, like, Daisy Dukes.
I'm the worst.
I'm so sorry. I feel like we should, you know, I really do want to talk about this with, like, respect.
No, it's just, like,
picturing her and Daisy Dukes is hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we're not trying to be disrespectful. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's just funny, because in my head, I'm thinking cow maiden, and my head goes, cowgirl? And I'm like, no, that's not what we're talking about. This is not a girl in a short jean skirt and cowboy boots. Yeah. We're talking about a literal part cow, part human hybrid that's not totally creepy. It's just like that's how they
and the Egyptians did that a lot, as we talked about last week.
With the different like falcon head and the hawk head and especially in their iconography.
Yes, for sure. So it's obviously very likely that depictions of Hathor Isis influence this story of Io. In some versions, the cow is actually another form of Hera, and indeed, the cow is a symbol of Hera. So it's really all just combining together here.
Yeah.
And I did not know this. This is pretty interesting. Impregnating somebody by the breath of a god is an Egyptian motif, and that's one of the versions of what happens here is that Zeus impregnated her with his breath, basically.
Problematic.
Yeah, just
this guy.
Don't stand too close, Zeus.
He even breathes on your arm.
Yeah, exactly.
Zeus causing all kinds of trouble.
Right? But I thought that was really interesting that that's a very common Egyptian motif and that in this story that's what happens there.
You know, just hearing, like, the respect that the Greeks have for Egyptian, like, knowledge and wisdom, it almost feels right that there's an Egyptian motif that, like, impregnating someone via your words, like, that wisdom being something that the Greeks revere so much, like, it does not shock me at all that the Egyptians themselves saw the wisdom in some of the things they were doing, and so seeing that kind of feels almost like full circle, like, there, breath is enough to create new life. Like, breath is enough to, you know, that makes a lot of sense, just with how much they seem to put on, like, the value of wisdom and knowledge and all of that as well.
Yeah. Her son was associated with the Egyptian bull god Apis, which you might remember a few minutes ago was one of the gods in Serapis.
Yes.
So, again, everything's just full circle, all coming together, all being mishmashed together. Io had to search for him when he was stolen by some group or another, and this part of the story seems to reflect Isis's travels in order to find the body of Osiris when he was killed by his brother, basically. So there's so many parts of this story that you can trace back to Egyptian mythology and Egyptian religion and culture. And it's just, it goes to show you how much that really did influence the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one I was really, really excited to learn about because we actually talked a lot about this one last week. And you were the one who put together Thoth and Hermes, sounding like they really went together, because Thoth was the scribe of the gods and Hermes is the messenger of the gods.
I'm just fist pumping myself over here. I don't know these things.
Yeah.
That's cool though.
I mean, it's so interesting that you immediately picked up on that, and this is actually like, it's a whole thing, Kristen. It is a whole thing.
I love it when I'm smart accidentally.
Right? And I decided not, this is one of the things that I could have done a whole deep dive on because it was so interesting to me, but I decided to keep it simple as I could.
And maybe this is something we revisit.
Right.
Because again, I know nothing. If Thoth plays a bigger role in the King Chronicles books later on, maybe we can kind of get back to this, because if it's that complicated and, like, interesting, I'm sure it would merit an entire episode. Yeah. But anyway, take it away.
And I believe somebody, I think I put it in our feedback section, I hope I did, somebody wrote specifically about how we were talking about Thoth last week.
Nice.
And I think they said that they're very excited because they're remembering some things that are coming, so maybe this will become very relevant at some point and we can talk about it more.
I like it.
So, in terms of, like, literature and stuff, the Book of Thoth was a blueprint for Greek literature known as Hermetica, which were works associated with Hermes. So, basically, Hermetica were, like, these whole bunch of books, essays, stories, like, things written down that they said Hermes wrote for them. Because Hermes, again, associated with, like, knowledge and stuff like that.
Is it bad that my brain thinks Encyclopedia Britannica? So, like, it kind of works, though, because it's basically the collection of things that,
Yeah.
Anyway.
Makes sense. And this influence really went both ways between them, mostly during the Hellenistic period, like we talked about, and the Roman period. And Thoth and Hermes combined forms, much like Amun-Ra, to become Hermes Trismegistus. I don't know if I said that right, but basically Hermes thrice greatest. And so the Egyptians and the Greeks really loved these two together. I mean, really just put them in high esteem, really believed, I feel like, more than some of the other gods, that they were really just the same person or different forms of the same person. And basically, as Greece expanded, Hermes' roles also expanded. We talked about in our Hermes episode how he's just the god of friggin' everything.
I believe we called him the junk drawer god. Yes. Because he does. He has so many things attributed to him because he's everywhere, yeah.
And during the Hellenistic period, where the Greeks were in charge of Egypt, we see him take on many of the roles attributed to Thoth. So, like, you can really see, if you were to study Hermes from when he kind of first emerged as a deity to later on, how his roles changed over that time period, and how the Egyptians, and Thoth specifically, was the one to kind of add to that trajectory, which is just, I don't know if you guys are finding this interesting, but like, my mind is blown.
Karen's loving it.
Yes, I do think this is really interesting. I think I've talked about this before, but one of the papers that I wrote in college was about Venus and basically how her roles have changed. And I think I did mention this last week in terms of like going from like a mother goddess to a more like sexual goddess and stuff like that. And it's just so interesting to study that path that they take and how the gods kind of change as they're needed to change. And obviously we see that with Serapis, you know, all these other gods kind of become this one god, and it's like the god that they need in that moment. And I find that so fascinating. That pretty much brings us to the end of this discussion. Like I said, there's so much more out there that I could have talked about, but I wanted to give you guys a taste of everything. And if you're interested, I will put the sources in there. Some of it is Wikipedia, I'll admit. Some of it is, you know, things that are a little bit more high value resources, I would say. Credible resources. And
resources you can cite in your research papers,
right,
versus sites, sources that you use to find other sources.
Right. That's what I love Wikipedia for, because it just puts it all in one place.
It's all there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I could have gone into so much more detail, but I was like, rein it in, Karen. We don't have time for all of that.
I think you did a really good job, because I feel like I'm not overwhelmed, but I see some of how they really did influence each other, and especially that it wasn't like takeover. It wasn't like the Greeks ran roughshod over Egypt and said, here's what we believe, and Egypt said, okay, well, I guess we'll take this, this, and this. They were really it's an assimilation. They're not just wiping out whole belief systems. They were working together to kind of figure out how they could coexist and how their beliefs could kind of become simpatico.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think that this is going to be really valuable information to have, even though it is just a brief overview, because it becomes relevant in this week's chapter. And I think because we've already looked so closely at Percy Jackson going into the Kane Chronicles, like you said, just trying to equate them in our heads and like see where they are similar and where they're different, something like this is going to be really important to kind of have in the back of our minds. And I also wanted to say briefly that the Greeks were not only influenced by the Egyptians. There are other societies that influenced them. And for example, the Chimera and the Sphinx are of Near Eastern origin. And we see some Indian influences as well. And I think we even talked about that in one of our Greek episodes, where one of the gods like goes to India, and there's like a whole, it might have been Hermes.
It might have been Hermes.
Yeah. And you can just see, like, how it's not like the Greeks were in this bubble. Like, they knew other pantheons existed. They knew other cultures existed. And they influenced them. You can't help it when you're neighbors like that, and you're trading and you're discovering the world. So
absolutely.
Maybe sometime in the future when we're looking for more episodes, that would be something really interesting to dive into. But for now, that was your brief overview. How did I do?
I think you did great.
All right, thanks.
I feel informed. I know that there's a big thing that I'm going to hopefully remember when it's important.
I'm so excited.
My head is going to explode with awesomeness, and I'm looking forward to that. But I really do think there is a lot to just have this discussion and kind of like look at it. It gives value to what we're going to do reading Kane Chronicles mm-hmm. and seeing, like, how things kind of do match up to Greek. Because, again, it's something you do without thinking about it. You're trying to logically make your brain understand it, so looking back to something you already understand well is just makes total sense.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to come in very handy. I absolutely do.
I hope so.
Okay. So now we are going to talk about Chapter 2 of The Red Pyramid, entitled An Explosion for Christmas. What everyone wants, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So they, meaning Carter, Sadie, and their dad, make their way into the closed museum with the curator, who is quite the fan of their father and his work. Turns out, they're there to see the Rosetta Stone, like the one that software is named after. The curator leaves them unattended with the glass opened and goes to find some papers from the archives. As soon as the curator is out of earshot, their father tells them they need to lock the curator in his office with a chain and padlock, and then Carter and Sadie need to stay out of the exhibit hall room that they are in right now. They do as they're told, sort of, but return to see their father standing in a glowing blue circle. They're not in the room, but they're watching from a nearby room. He's also waving a boomerang around, or something that seems to be a boomerang, and he seems to be writing on the Rosetta Stone in, like, glowing hieroglyphics, it appears. Suddenly, Sadie seems to know exactly what symbols he's writing and what they mean, and is translating them live in color for Carter, who's confused because he definitely has tried to study hieroglyphics and doesn't know what all of them mean like that. So then the Rosetta Stone explodes and brings the room into chaos and knocks a whole bunch of stuff over, including knocking Carter out. And when he wakes up, he slowly sees this fiery man creature kind of materialize between him and his father. Like, his father clearly sees this guy first, and Carter's just kind of waiting. And as he's sitting there, like, he starts to see around what I'm going to call the mist and sees this fiery man. So it does not seem like this is who his father was trying to summon, because you get that his father's doing something, and then his father, who is named Julius by the fiery guy, so I'm calling him Julius. Julius seems a little on edge and a little freaked out about what's happened, so clearly he didn't plan this. It seems that Julius, their father, has released five of something instead of what he wanted to, including this fireman. The fireman and Carter's dad exchange some cryptic words and seem to be very much at odds. Julius tries to stop the fireman by throwing a staff at him that turns into a serpent. It does nothing and is destroyed very easily by Mr. Fire Guy. Then the fireman encases Julius in a sarcophagus and sends him into the ground. Sadie throws a rock, which falls through the fireman, but does no damage. He tries to attack Carter and Sadie then, but is stopped mystically by something inches from their faces. He retreats when the man and the girl from the needle that they saw before appear. And those two mention something about destroying, quote-unquote, them, and then Carter passes out from exhaustion and craziness because, yeah.
It was a lot to take in.
Yeah. And a big fiery burst when the fireman disappeared, and that would knock me out, too. Okay, so there's still a lot that I do not understand. And so therefore I have to use words like fireman and boomerang thingy. And I mean, I know Carter and Sadie don't really know what's going on either.
Right.
But it makes it really hard to describe what thing you think they're talking about when you don't have the word for it.
I find this very interesting. I was thinking about this as I was reading the chapter. Carter does know a lot about ancient Egypt and a lot about the mythology and the culture and everything like that. And Sadie doesn't. So she's kind of our window into this world in a lot of ways because he has to explain things to her, which is always a really great way to, like, explain things to your readers as
Absolutely.
Well. But Carter doesn't know everything, and he's very much in the dark. Like, his dad is very purposely keeping him in the dark.
Yes.
So there's just a lot that we won't know until somebody explains it to us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like, I know this is probably super frustrating to people who've read this book, and they're like, Kristen, it's so-and-so. And I'm like, I know, but I don't know, and I'll know soon, hopefully. Anyway. Okay, so we learn I'm just going to kind of slide by some seemingly unimportant things. I don't know. I thought it was important to note that Carter's dad translated Imhotep's spells, and we learned in the chapter that Imhotep was a magician. I don't know if it's... I think magician, and I think magic tricks and funny. But I'm assuming that this is more like a purveyor of magic, which in this book probably is closer to like a wizard. I don't know that yet, but that's kind of what my brain is kind of putting together here. And Curator Dude is a really big fan, so like he kind of gushes over Carter's dad. Carter and Sadie's dad. I thought it was also worth noting that in the chapter, Sadie looks so different from her father and brother, which we knew from the first one, that people, like, kind of go dumb. Like, they get struck dumb when they say, that's my sister.
Yeah.
Like, really? I mean, I kind of get it, but at the same time, it's like, you think it would... I don't think... The guy in the chapter, like, literally pauses.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, is it really that... No, like... Shocking.
I thought this was really interesting because I feel like these days this is something that especially our generation, millennials and the generation after us, I almost said before us, the younger ones, Gen Z, I feel like this is something that is not as surprising to us. It's something that we're kind of more aware of and it doesn't shock us, basically. Yeah. But I can understand even a little while ago when this book was written and the fact that the curator is probably older, that this would be something that would, like, stop somebody in their tracks. It's very rude, I understand that that was probably a thing. What I also really liked about this part was, like, Carter specifically says, and remember, he's recording this and Sadie is sitting right next to him, that he hates when this happens because it's just, like... really sad. Like, it makes him upset that people don't realize that she's his sister.
Or that people react to it like it's weird or different or wrong. And that,
so even though these two aren't very close, Carter still has this familial bond with Sadie where he gets defensive over people's reactions to her.
Yeah. Definitely worth noting.
Yeah.
We quickly learn that they're all three of them are there at the museum to see the Rosetta Stone. And I kind of liked that Sadie equated it to the software and, like, the language thing, because that's exactly what it is. The Rosetta Stone software, language learning software, is named after the Rosetta Stone, which we learn has three languages inscribed on it. And we, in this chapter, because I don't know all that much stuff about this sort of thing, found out that the actual inscription on it is not very important. It was a thank you note, I believe, from one person to another, but it has three languages inscribed on it. So the same message, I'm guessing, in three languages. And it's ancient Egyptian, Demotic, which is a mix of Egyptian and Greek, and then Greek. So because you can see how they affect each other, you can then translate from Egyptian to Greek and back, and that's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, this was huge in terms of, like, being able to learn Egyptian hieroglyphics and what they mean, because they knew what Greek was, they already knew how to, like, translate that, and then going backwards to ancient Egyptian, there was a reason why the Rosetta Stone is so iconic. I mean, this was very, very, very important in terms of, like, archaeology and history and all of that. And this was, I had never, or if I had, I'd forgotten that I read about Demotic language previously, but this was something that I read about, and that's what I was talking about earlier when we were talking about, like, the Minoans and, you know, that transitionary language and everything, the proto language. So I read about it today, and then for it to pop up in the chapter, I was like, oh, this was such a good idea. I'm so glad we did this episode.
Yes. Us just getting it right on target.
I know.
Okay, so also something that I thought was noteworthy, their dad mentions regular mortals and then quickly, like, talks over himself to kind of hide that he said regular mortals. So that clearly gives me flags that dad is not a regular mortal, or he knows a lot of people who are not regular mortals.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know which.
It's a very big slip of the tongue.
Yes. Quite important.
He was a little panicked, though, so I'll give him a pass on that.
And also very excited because he's staring at the Rosetta Stone, and you can see the things are turning, and he's very excited about what's about to happen. After their dad, like, settles into the room, and he sends the curator out. As he sends the curator out, he talks to Sadie and Carter and has, like, some very quick words with them,
just basically saying, like, I think he looks at Carter and he says, trust me. Like, he doesn't say much more than that, but it's just like, you have to trust that what I'm doing is the right thing. And then he looks at Sadie and is like, I know you don't know me that well, but I'm hoping this will make all of our lives better. I promise you I'm not crazy. Like, you know. And that's it. And then he basically says, go lock the curator in his office and don't come in this room.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Dad. Sure. Why not? Like, I mean, I can understand Carter listening to this and saying, okay, Dad, because he's come across some crazy things before with Dad. Right. And I can see him following and stepping in line. But I don't understand why their dad thinks that Sadie's just going to be like, okay, sure.
I think the only thing that I really can come up with is, like, yes, Sadie is a lot bolder than Carter and a lot more rebellious, but she's also 12, and this is her dad. So
it's true.
That's for true. Him to be like, go do this thing, she's probably doesn't feel like she has much of a choice. But
yeah,
we can see that the Sadie comes out in her pretty quickly.
Pretty soon, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the kids do as asked, and they go lock the curator away. Sadie's very excited about this.
yeah. And then, maybe that's why she did it. Right. She's like, lock an adult up in his room? Yeah, of course I'll do that.
Absolutely. And they wander back, basically down the hallway, toward the room they were in before. And they kind of stay outside of the hall, but they're watching what's going on. And so they see a blue light emanating from the room, and as they get closer, they see that their dad is standing in that circle of blue light, which I can't help but think of, like, Supernatural and the Salt
Circles. Oh, yeah.
It's like, it's blue and glowing. And he's using a tool that's kind of shaped like a boomerang, and he's carving hieroglyphics onto the Rosetta Stone, and they're glowing. Right. As he writes them, they're glowing.
Yeah. This scene was so cinematic, by the way. Oh, yeah. I was like, this is gonna look so cool in the movie. Like, I can just envision them turning, seeing the blue light coming from the room, and then seeing all this light and all the crazy stuff that's happening with their dad. Like, oh, it's gonna be so cool.
Like, them walking down a dark hallway, and you can see blue light coming from the room, and they're like, we have to figure out what's, you know, we have to go see what's going on. Yeah. And then, yeah, you can see it all kind of unfold. It is very cinematic, for sure. Okay, so he uses the boomerang to carve the hieroglyphics, and as he's doing so, Sadie somehow immediately is able to decipher the images. Like, she can see them well enough, or something, that she can read it and knows that the one he's carving that has ram horns above it means open. And she says, open, and Carter's like, huh?
Yeah.
Because
I think at least part of it was her father was saying it, like, out loud. And Carter even says something about Osiris, like, the way he pronounces Osiris is different than he had ever heard, which maybe that's how it would have been pronounced in the Egyptian language.
Yeah.
But this part, like, do not remember what's going on, and I have no idea why Sadie can do this and Carter can't. If they're siblings, you would think that maybe they have, you know, going back to Percy Jackson, that they would have similar powers or something like that.
Right.
But,
well, this is pure speculation on my part. I have a feeling that there's something super special going on with Sadie, and that is the reason why her and her father can't be in the same place all year round.
Ooh, okay.
Like, there's a reason why Carter is with him and Sadie is not, and why he doesn't fight harder for his daughter to be with him like Carter.
Right.
I don't know what it is, but I can kind of already sense that there's something about her that must be separated from her dad. Otherwise, it would be too much power in one place, or it would be, you know, whatever. Like, I feel like there's something that's keeping them from being together. And this kind of makes my spidey sense tingle.
Yeah.
Because she clearly has some ability and has never studied this, is not, you know, she's not Carter, who has been putting in the time. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, she's able to read these symbols, so clearly something's going on.
Yeah, and that makes it so much more interesting that it's her and not Carter, too.
Yeah.
I also wanted to talk really quickly about the fact that Rick includes the symbols on the pages, includes the hieroglyphics on the pages, so we don't have to use our imagination to picture what it looks like. It's right there in front of us. And between that and the fact that this is a recording where you get them kind of having these asides sometimes, makes this book feel so interactive and so, like, in the moment that I think I find myself feeling a lot more, like, tense and, like, really feeling the suspense a lot more, because it just feels like it's right there, it's happening right in the moment.
I also want to say,
knowing that, okay, there is that, and I feel that, like, it's very intense.
Mm-hmm.
But then also knowing that they're telling the story makes my little romance reading heart not freak out, because in romance, a happy ending is guaranteed. Somehow, Sadie and Carter make it through some part of this to tell the story.
Right.
I don't know when that's going to end or how this all works out 5 chapters from now. But right now, I know that they're going to survive this moment because they're going to tell me the story about it. So that makes me feel better as a reader. Like, I'm not going to get invested in these two and then they're going to disappear in a chapter.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I do get that, like, intense thing going on, but it also is, like, reassuring that, like, don't panic.
Yeah.
A little bit of both.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay, so, as their dad is writing on the Rosetta Stone, apparently something happens, and the Rosetta Stone explodes.
Mm-hmm.
And it trashes the room.
I was so sad.
I know, knocking over sarcophaguses and crashing vases, and
this made me so, so sad.
And the stone explodes just as their father looks over and kind of sees them. So he's aware that they're there, and he's in his little light circle, and their dad has, I guess, like, one cut on his forehead, but other than that, he's pretty much okay. Carter and Sadie were both knocked out. Carter comes to, and that's when he sees this fiery outline of a dude. And Sadie is still knocked out and kind of on the ground near Carter. Okay, so here's where we get into the land of things that don't make any sense. But it's okay, because it will make sense eventually, and then I will have names and it will not be weird.
Yes.
So, the fiery outline of a man is standing between them. He calls their dad Julius. We don't know why or how or if that's his actual dad name, or if it's, like, another name that this guy knows him by.
I, not knowing anything, again, I would assume this is his real name. What's more interesting is not that, you know, whether or not this is his real name, which I just assumed it was. It's the fact that this thing knows him enough to call him by his first name.
Which is also definitely worth noting. That is for sure. Yeah, they seem to be very familiar with each other. And Julius declares pretty quickly that he did not summon whatever this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
So this was not what he was trying to do. Something else happened.
Right.
Which we're used to when it comes to Percy. So I'm not, you know, things happen sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay, so he then briefly mentions that the house will not be enough to... The fiery man says, like, the house will not be enough to stop me.
Capital H house.
Right, capital H house. Which makes me think that these two generic bozos who were about to walk in on the scene at the end of the chapter are from the house, which means that the man in the hat and the trench coat from the house last chapter was probably from the house.
Yes, capital H house. I wish you could have just seen the dance that Kristen did when she was explaining that. It was so funny. Also, this was the best decision we ever made to talk about something that you have no, like, background information for, because your wild theories and, like, gesticulations are just giving me life right now.
I mean, I can't, when I don't know what I'm talking about, I flail a little, so
yeah.
I'm sorry that you all can't see me gesticulating wildly.
I'm gonna set up a secret camera.
Oh, great. Should do my hair next time.
Yeah.
Okay, so we get this little thing about the house, but then we don't hear anything else about him. So it's nice to kind of have a little bit of a mention, because now at least I have something to go on.
Mm-hmm.
Then Mr. Fireman says, "I am never summoned, Julius, but when you open a door, you must be prepared for guests to walk through."
Yeah.
That never ends well. As a fan of Vampire Diaries and the originals, people just start walking through, and then you have to corral evil spirits and ghosts and vampires and whatever. So,
yeah.
I'm not encouraged by this news that there are 5 guests. We quickly learned that there are 5 guests who walked through this door, and the fireman is one of them, and he's not Julius's friend, so therefore he's probably not our friend.
Right, exactly. But so interesting that Julius wanted to open a door, did open a door,
thought somebody was going to come through said door,
but the wrong person came through, so...
And brought his friends.
Yes. Very interesting.
Now it's a scary house party.
Yes.
Not capital H house. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so at this moment, as this is all going on, Julius is keeping this fireman's attention, and Carter drags Sadie, who's still unconscious, to safety behind a column, and he it covers her mouth and it wakes her up. So now Sadie is fully conscious and awake and fine and is next to Carter, and they're watching all of this unfold. So their dad uses a tool from his box, and it's a small ruler thing that extends really quickly into a long staff. He throws it at the fireman's feet and it changes into a serpent. And all of that description is really important, but not at all, because the fireman dissolves it into ash in, like, 2 seconds.
Yeah. I'm like, was this the tool that he's always had on him that's, like, been able to do stuff and then, like,
but, like, now the boomerang also came out of said box and that's was, like, true. A magic thing. So I'm curious if there's more to this magic box or if it's just these two things. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. So then Julius asks, how many did I release? And the fireman says, all 5. So.
Not great.
Definitely not great. I, of course, want to ask all 5 what, but we're not going to get the answer to that just yet, so we're going to have to wait. Then our fire dude erases the blue circle around Julius, who is then encased by a glowing, clear coffin, which soon materializes fully into a, like, thick gold sarcophagus, and fully adorned, and sinks into the ground as if it was water, and is just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And as I would if I were Carter or Sadie, they start freaking out.
Yeah.
Dad!
So, this obviously reminds me a little bit of Percy and his mom. Mm-hmm. You know, his mom being taken away and everything like that. Vastly different situations. Yes. And vastly different kinds of characters. But kind of a similar setup between the two books. I was just, you know, drawing similarities there. Right now,
okay.
Are you worried about his father?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm worried about Dad. I'm worried, especially considering this next phrase that I'm about to say, because Fireman doesn't just leave it at bye-bye, Dad. He also says goodbye, Osiris.
Yeah.
Which obviously makes me, because Julius is also Osiris. So now I'm curious if his dad is, like, a physical form named Julius that embodies Osiris, or if Osiris was trapped in Julius's body, or if Osiris was trapped in the Rosetta Stone, or I don't know. Like, there's so many things that could be going on here. But clearly, Julius and Osiris are linked. And whether Osiris needed Julius to be free or is a part of Julius, he is now trapped.
Right.
That's the bottom line here.
Mm-hmm.
After their dad sinks, Sadie picks up a chunk of the building. And she chucks it at the fireman, kind of to get his attention, or basically just, she's pissed because her dad just disappeared. The fireman reacts. He turns and sees them. His whole time he's been paying attention to Julius. He turns and sees them and lunges toward them, but is stopped and cannot touch them, literally inches from their faces. And the amulet around Carter's neck starts to grow hot. And we know that both Carter and Sadie have an amulet, and they wear it all the time. So then Mr. Fire Dude says, so, it's you.
Interesting.
This is problematic and troubling and worrisome. It's going to be dramatic.
Also, can I just say, because I forgot to mention this last week, there are like 41 or 2 chapters in this book. We're going to be reading this for almost a year. This is going to be such a slow path to the end of this book
I should just become one with my frustration.
Yes. Okay. That was what I was going for.
It's gonna take a minute. All right. Yeah. We'll get there eventually. Okay, so at that moment that the fireman, like, realizes their significance, a wall at the far end of the room explodes. What else is new? And the man and the girl that they saw at Cleopatra's Needle in the last chapter come walking through the now opening. And the fireman, like, kind of says, like, I'll be back or something like that. And he leaves in a burst of flame, sending Carter into a heap of limbs on the floor. And just before he passes out, the man and girl can be seen standing over him and they say, we must be sure before we destroy them. And then Carter faints.
Yeah.
I immediately do not believe that the them they want to destroy is Carter and Sadie.
Okay.
They want to destroy the necklaces. That's my prediction.
Okay.
Because I don't think killing them is the answer to all the house's problems. I think it has something to do with the amulets. And the reason she said destroy and not kill is because it's not them, it's like a thing. So I don't know, but that's my guess.
Yeah. I think that's very logical to come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
My big question here is, do you know who the fireman is?
I do not. I feel like maybe I'm supposed to know. When I saw this question right before we started the podcast, I was literally just scrolling through, and I saw this question at the end, and I went, clearly I'm supposed to know.
I would say that if you were paying close attention to last week, it is very obvious who Fireman is.
My brain doesn't work that way.
That's okay. I would say that there were two very large clues as to who this is. I'm not going to say it because I want it to be a surprise for you when we get to there. But for any of our listeners who are also reading this for the first time, if you remember anything from last week, I think you could come up with a pretty good guess as to who this was. Are you trying to...
Now I feel dumb.
No, it's not dumb.
I'm looking at last week's notes and I'm trying to figure it out.
I don't know. It's okay.
I don't like not knowing. This is a bad choice. Why did we pick this?
2 seconds ago, I was like, this was such a great idea. Then again, I know.
Right. So. It's so much easier to be you.
Yeah.
I can tell you that.
I'm not frustrated.
Well, the funny thing is, you are especially not used to me being not in the know because I have never been a newbie on Rewatchable.
Oh, that's true.
I've always had to be a super fan, so I've never had the experience of, like, people watching me experience things for the first time. Yeah. I'm always the one introducing people to things, so this is very new.
I will say, one time where you did watch something that I had already seen was Hamilton.
Yeah.
And I kept looking over at you and it made you very uncomfortable because I just wanted to see all of your reactions and you were like, stop looking at me. Like, sorry.
I'm supposed to have reactions and I don't know how.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So that wraps up the chapter.
Yeah.
I do not know what's going on.
That's okay.
I'm not supposed to. That I will get answers.
Yeah.
But I am definitely entertained and interested in what is going on.
Yeah, he does a really good job of immediately setting up the action. We have a lot of questions. We have, like, a lot of different elements. The house and whatever the fireman is. And then Carter and Sadie and their dad.
Mother.
Yeah, their mom. Like, there's a lot of history. There's a lot of stuff that happened in the past. Stuff that's happening now. And we're only on chapter 2.
Yes.
So... hopefully chapter 3, I would imagine, if the house people, you know, they're going to take them maybe to the house, capital H.
Possible.
And we might get some answers in the next chapter, so maybe you'll be less frustrated next week.
That was kind of my thought, is it's, you know, it doesn't usually take that long to get into a story, to get to the point where you have to know stuff. And I feel like now we're kind of at that point. So starting with next chapter, I'm hoping we'll start to get some real clues as to what's going on. So we have to do our favorite quotes and our favorite moments. I'm going to start with my favorite quote because it comes from Carter and it's toward the beginning of the chapter. And I think I loved it so much is because it's so Percy-esque.
Yeah, it is.
It's the same. Percy could have said this.
Yeah.
At 70 different occasions when they were in a museum. He could have said, "We were locked in a museum surrounded by guards and high-tech security. Nobody could bother us in here." I hoped. Yeah. Like, with all the monsters and all of that, like, I could totally see Percy saying this. So it just, again, it kind of made him and Carter in my head just kind of have very similar selves.
Yeah.
But I loved that little bit because it's very true. You would think you could be safe.
Yeah.
And then you're not. Karen, what was yours?
Well, I wanted to give a shout out to Sadie's line about the Rosetta Stone because that was pretty funny.
It was.
Like, not knowing it was more than just a computer program. But we actually already talked about mine when the fireman said, "When you open a door, you must be prepared for guests to walk through," because that is just a badass line.
It is.
It's so good.
It is.
Yeah.
And, like, there was no way to describe it without quoting it. So I was like, I just kind of have to go for it. But I'm glad you picked it because it really does feel like a very specific, iconic moment.
Yeah.
Like
that's
you did this, Julius, whatever your name is, Osiris, whoever you are. You did this, not me. Like, you opened the door, I'm just the guy who walked through an open door. Don't look at me.
Yeah, I didn't do anything wrong.
Right, exactly. My favorite moment was Sadie being able to decipher the hieroglyphics. It's really mysterious, yeah. And I'm very intrigued as to what that means for her, especially because she doesn't really have an interest in any of this. So
yeah, she's probably like, man.
It's not knowledge she just kind of has. It's something in her that allowed her to read that. So right. I thought that was cool. What was yours?
The idea that you could be left alone with the Rosetta Stone. That was so cool. Like, I would have loved that.
I loved how the curator says, we normally wouldn't do this, and then looks at the children.
Yeah.
Like, especially you, you little snot-nosed children. Do not sneeze on it. Okay? Yeah. But he trusts Mr. Carter.
Which he shouldn't have, because now the Rosetta Stone has exploded.
Right. And is now a smoldering pile of embers at their feet.
Yeah.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts as well. You can tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack, is currently getting the same treatment. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com if you have a little more to say that won't fit in the other forms. You can find our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that is awesome. You can leave us questions or comments or ideas for content or episodes you want to hear from us in any of these places. We really love hearing from you guys. And in that, we do have some feedback this week. We got a couple of emails, I think, and Karen is going to guide us through those.
Yeah, we got quite a few emails this week, which made me super happy, and from some people that we haven't heard from before, so that was very exciting.
We love new people.
Yes. So Edward wrote in and said, I was rereading The Last Olympian when I had a theory about how Annabeth knew Percy's Achilles spot. We all know that until House of Hades, Annabeth wielded her knife. As Luke describes the weapon, he says that the knife was a weapon for the intelligent and quick. It can't do a ton of damage like a sword, but it was useful in finding weak spots in enemies' armor. So in fighting with a knife, Annabeth had to learn the weakest points in the armor. So after Hestia told the campers that Percy bathed in the River Styx, Annabeth possibly started to think where Percy's weak spot would be. On the small of Percy's back was a hard spot to stab from an enemy's point of view. Enemies would just decide to attack there, but with a purpose. But then, since Chapter 7, Percy was more attentive to his back, and Annabeth clearly noticed it. So in Chapter 12, Percy possibly confirmed her suspicions of his Achilles spot, proving Annabeth's possible intentions for taking the knife. I actually really like this theory in terms of, like, it's Annabeth's intelligence and maybe something that she wasn't even consciously thinking of. But the fact that, yeah, you're right, with a knife you have to train to know people's weak spots. You have to be able to find the chinks in their armor. She probably had the same thought that Percy did in terms of the small of the back would be the best place to have an Achilles spot like that.
Well, and I'm curious, like, as I was reading this, the knife... Oh, okay. No, that makes more sense. My brain thought that the knife was, like, kind of... It had a little bit of magical ability and that it could help her find weak spots. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that if she is drawn to certain weak spots, then strong points are going to be, like, almost the opposite, like, right. Repelled.
Maybe she's
so, like, she could feel some of that, yeah, pull, too. But I do like this. I mean, it's fine to think that it's just Annabeth knows and feels Percy and is so in tune that it works. But I like the idea that she actually put pieces together without even necessarily thinking about it and was able to kind of deduce that there's a good chance his weak spot is on his back, you know, not facing his enemies, and is somewhere that's usually protected.
Right.
I really, yeah, do think that's awesome.
As a daughter of Athena, it is not outside the realm of possibility that she had just figured it out.
Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah. So thank you, this, Edward. That was really awesome.
Yeah.
Rowan also wrote in, and Rowan says, "Hi, I'm Rowan, and I'm a big fan of your podcast. And I noticed in the latest episode, someone asked you to do an episode on demigods and magicians, but you seem to think that that meant doing an episode on comparing demigod life to Kane Chronicles life, but Demigods and Magicians is a book by Rick Riordan. I think that's what Quiva was asking you to do an episode on, the book Demigods and Magicians, not comparing demigod life to Kane Chronicle life." You are absolutely correct. And when I read that email, it did not occur to me that that was the name of the book. So, and several people pointed this out to me. So thank you, everybody who wrote in about this. You are absolutely right. And sorry, Quiva, that I misinterpreted your email. We are definitely 100% absolutely going to be talking about the book, Demigods and Magicians. We're going to do all of the supplemental material, and that is part of what I was talking about earlier in this episode in terms of just, like, really important things. And, yeah, we have to do this. So we're going to do it. Don't worry. This next question from Rowan, I'm not sure we're going to be able to answer because it might take a lot of thinking. But Rowan also said, who would you fan cast as Tyson, Talia, Hera, and Hestia for the PJO TV show? We might have to do this when the season 2 gets greenlit, maybe?
That might be a really good time to do that. Yeah, because we're hoping that we'll get that before season 1 airs. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a good chance. Yeah, that might be something to kind of jump into then. I would like to do that.
Right.
It sounds like a lot of fun. We always have fun with the fan cast.
Yeah. But I have to, like, sit down and think about this. I don't know that I can just, like, come up with it. But
plus, I feel like that's enough. With the four characters, that's enough kind of for an entire episode.
Mm-hmm.
So we will definitely hold on to this. And thank you, Rowan, for asking.
Yeah.
But I think we will hold on to this and get back to it in a full episode at some point.
Yeah. Henry also wrote in and said, the other thing I wanted to bring up was actually something I planned to put in last week's email, but I left it out because the email was already so long. It was to do with the timeline discrepancy in The Singer of Apollo that I discovered where Percy is already supposed to be missing, as this should be set after The Lost Hero. As I was typing that whole thing out, I realized that there should really be some sort of dating system in which we can keep track of which year, which event, in which book takes place. Since Rick Riordan explained in his blog that the events in the Riordanverse are not fixed in real time and do not run concurrently with real time, it gave me the idea that, as a fandom, we should create our own year dating system where we date the events using the Gregorian date and month as used in the books, but designate each year as a totally different calendar system. If you're like, what the heck does that mean? Like I was the first time I was reading this. Don't worry. Henry gives us examples, which is amazing.
We love Henry.
Yes. For example, Percy's birthday is in August, but we can't say that he was born in 1993. Instead, we can say something like he was born in August 18th, 12 BD, before discovery that he was a demigod. And then the Lightning Thief would take place in the year 1 AI, Anno Inventionis, in the year of the discovery. I love that, by the way. I'm geeking out right now.
I am so, too.
The Sea of Monsters would be in the year 2 AI, and then all the years of the Riordanverse afterwards will be dated accordingly. This would make a lot of sense to start dating the years from the Lightning Thief, since it is the year in which the Riordanverse quite literally began, the year in which Percy left normalcy in blissful ignorance forever, met Annabeth and Grover, discovered Camp Half-Blood, and the world that Percy Jackson fans all over the world love was born. With this new system, fans all over can start deliberating over the chronology of the events across all Riordanverse books with an accurate dating system that isn't rooted in real time.
My mind is blown, and I love this, and it's so smart because we've all kind of been like, okay, so he's writing a new Percy book. Does that make Percy 25 or whatever?
Right,
we're always trying to figure out, like, what's going on. And Rick has made it clear that Percy is still 17 and oops, time, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of love this because it lets us stop thinking about our earthly year system.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can still use, you know, months and days as we normally do. But yeah. And I love the terms you came up with.
I know.
Before discovery and the Anno Inventionis, like, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I think it's really, really clever. It's super cool. I love this. I do not want to be the person to do this, but if Henry or anybody else wants to, like, take this and run, I think it would be really interesting to come up with. I feel like years ago in the fandom, I feel like there was, like, a timeline chart at some point. I vaguely remember that. I don't know if I'm thinking of this specifically or maybe something else. But something like that where, yeah, you can have this, like, before everything started happening, time period, after everything, and even put in things like May Castellan and, like, those other events that we know that happened in the past, Hades and Maria D'Angelo, all right. that kind of stuff, to actually put it in a timeline that you'd be able to see. I would love that.
I mean, yeah.
That would be really cool.
For sure. And it's and going to so be helpful. A lot of work.
It's so helpful when we're discussing these things to, like, just look back at it and see, like, when everything takes place.
Absolutely. And with the new series, or the new book, we know of a book, kind of being placed back before so many of these, it would be really, really helpful to have something to look at and say, okay, so this and this already happened, but this didn't. And, yeah,
mm-hmm.
If anyone wants to take on this project, we would love you forever.
Yes.
Including you, Henry, for coming up with a very brilliant idea.
Yeah, I think, like, this is awesome. Really cool.
Yeah.
We got another email from Teddy, who says, "Hi, Karen and Kristen. I love Prophecy Radio and have been listening since day one. I love the podcast, and you guys are really funny."
Thanks.
Aww. So thanks for doing that and keep doing amazing. I did fall into a slump where I couldn't keep up with the episodes, and I don't remember what the prophecy count was. Do you? Oh, and besides the Percy Jackson books, do you have any other good recommendations for middle grade novels similar to them? By the way, my friend and I are coming to the Boston Sun and the Stars signing, so I hope to see you there. Keep up the great work.
Aww.
Yes. I don't know what I'm going to do at the signing yet, whether I'm going to, like, wear something special and, like, maybe just step aside so that people can come say hi and I can talk to people or whatever. But there's definitely a few people that I've seen in the fandom who are going to this one, so
nice.
I would love to do something. We'll figure that out closer to that date.
Yeah.
I did go back and look. We are currently at prophecy count number 32.
Fabulous.
We haven't gotten any prophecies yet in King Chronicles, but I'm sure there will be some. There's always prophecies, so
yeah.
And in terms of recommendations for middle grade novels similar to Percy Jackson, obviously the first thing I'm going to recommend is any of the Rick Riordan Presents books.
Mm-hmm.
I feel particularly, maybe I'm biased, that Aro Shah by Roshni Chokshi is very similar in vibe to Percy Jackson. I think Aro and Percy are, like, they have similar personalities. So definitely start with those. That was also the first one out of the imprint, so that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I also kind of did some Googling. I haven't read all of these suggestions, but from what I remember hearing about them, I feel like they could be a pretty good fit too. So Fablehaven by Brandon Mull, Shinji Takahashi and The Mark of the Kotal by Julie Kagawa. I have read books by Julie before. She's a very good writer. This looks like it should be in the Rick Riordan Presents imprint, but it's not. But it's very much very
in
similar.
That vein,
yeah. I would also suggest Artemis Fowl by Owen Colfer, because even though Artemis Fowl is nothing like Percy, he's a lot meaner than Percy.
Yeah.
It's definitely that, like, adventure. There's a lot of, like, fairies involved and just, like, mystical things. So I feel like that would be a great place to start. And Owen Colfer is, like, one of the funniest people that I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. And if you like the humor in Percy Jackson, I feel like you would like the humor in Artemis Fowl. And then the last one is a very personal recommendation for me. This actually showed up on a list, and I was like, well, I can't not put it in there now. The Lost Years of Merlin by T.A. Barron is one of my favorite books of all time, and it's very different from Percy Jackson. Obviously, it's about Merlin, and it's not quite the same vibe, but it's still a very good book. T.A. Barron also wrote an Atlantis series. I think the first book is called Atlantis Rising. It's I like the Merlin books better, but if you're looking for that same sort of, like, mythological connection, I mean, Merlin is sort of that same thing, but
yeah.
If Atlantis interests you, then check out those books. But The Lost Years of Merlin, I haven't read it in a while, but it's stayed with me since I was a kid, so.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Did you have any recommendations, or did I do, are you looking at my bookshelf?
I looked at your bookshelf. I don't read a ton of middle grade besides the Rick Riordan Presents books, and obviously, like, Percy and Rick's books.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that kind of came to me is, if you're looking, I mean, it's not really comparable, but it kind of falls into the same vein, would be, like, Chris Colfer's fantasy books, because they're more of, like,
fairy tale
related, mm-hmm. but they have a bit of a similar humor.
And that, like, adventure vibe.
Right, and they have, you know, it's not Percy-esque, but I feel like you have two kids who kind of get sucked into a fairy tale book and world, and they're trying to figure all that out. So it does kind of have a similar
thing. I've read a couple of those, and they're very good. Like, he's a very good writer.
I haven't read them all, but I also have read, like, maybe two or three of them, and they were really good fun, and the only reason I fell off of them is because I was waiting for them and just kind of lost track, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the only one I can think of that would really fit middle grade, really.
Yeah.
A lot of them are YA, the ones that come to mind.
If anyone else has any other suggestions, let us know and we will pass them along next week.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We also got a message from Nicholas on Twitter who said that we should add our dreams from last week to the prophecy count, but the other night I dreamt that I murdered somebody, so let's not. I was literally, like, trying to hide the evidence. Like, I stabbed them. I tried to hide it. I don't know who I stabbed.
I'm gonna leave. Before Karen finds a nut.
Yes.
No. Yeah, that's funny, though. I like the...
Yeah.
If only I was prophesying in my dreams.
Yeah, I'm glad that I wasn't, if last night's dream is what we're going off of.
Yeah, I too am grateful. All right, so that brings us to our goodbyes. Next week, we thought a little about this. We want to take a moment to look at Lance Reddick and his body of work and just appreciate what he has given us so far and kind of think and love the fact that we still have his performance in Percy Jackson in addition to maybe other projects, because I don't know what he's already shot prior to his death. We want to just kind of celebrate him, and so we're going to watch a couple of movies this week and kind of prepare and talk a little about him as an actor and what he gave to us.
And what we can expect maybe out of his performance for Zeus. So we'll, you know, we'll obviously tie it back to Percy Jackson, but it feels like the right thing to do to just take a moment and look back on everything he's done.
Yeah, so we're going to do that. We'll also be discussing Red Pyramid Chapter 3, so we're not losing any ground there, but
maybe we get some answers.
Yeah, but for our regular discussion, we're going to step away from the Egypt for a second and focus on Lance, which I think it'll be really fun to look at everything he's done. And
there's a movie that I saw that he did that I'm very excited to watch, so.
So, yeah, we will report back.
Yes.
But until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.